Hi, I'm Jane Austere, and this is Doing It by the Book. This podcast is going to contain some pretty explicit content. If you're under 18, you'd better stop listening and go ask your parents. Hello, this is episode 16, and I'm recording on Sunday, August 3rd, 2014. Now, this is going to be something a little different than normal. This past weekend, I had an amazing opportunity to go to LeakyCon in Orlando, Florida. Because I didn't really get a chance to find guest hosts for this week and really dig deep into this chapter, I decided I would give you some sound bites from the brilliant minds of some of the professional writers I got to see at the con. Some panels did talk about trashy books and why we like them, and I want to share them with you. Now, Chapter 9 is something worth talking about, so I promise next week we'll include some thoughts on that chapter. But seriously, how often do you get to hear famous writers talk about writing in their favorite books? I mean, come on. So for those of you who don't know what LeakyCon is, LeakyCon started out originally as a solely Harry Potter convention, and it grew massively into almost any fandom that you can think of. Tumblr has been a huge part of that growth, and so have the many television shows, YouTube channels, etc. that have been involved with LeakyCon. So things like the Harry Potter actors, of course, and Hunger Games actors were there, but there were also wizard rock bands, and there were supernatural writers there, and there were people who do Harry Potter parodies there. It was everything that you could possibly imagine this year. And it was in Orlando, Florida, because of the new opening of the park in the Universal Studios theme park. So that's another huge thing, too. I went, and I got to focus on the lit track, which is essentially all of the writers that were there that had books that were selling were there, and I got to go to the panels that they were presenting at. Maureen Johnson was the lit track director, so she was the main person that everyone was really excited to see. And if you haven't read any of her books, she's really awesome and funny and writes in a very, very interesting and funny tone. And even in her more serious works, she does a really good job of distinguishing between her funny voice and her I'm a young adult writer and her this is serious and this is going to be an adult kind of writing. So definitely check out her book. She's got a lot. I'll make sure to put some of them in the show notes. So some of the awesome voices you may hear on this panel are Lori Halls Anderson, who wrote Speak and several other young adult historical fiction that is just truly amazing. She is a great and amazing writer. Aliyah Johnson, who has her first book published. It's called The Summer Prince. It looks awesome. It's set in Brazil, and it's about ritualistic sacrifice. So check that out. Varian Johnson, who wrote The Great Green Heist, and he's so funny and hilarious. He's got to be one of my favorite new authors that I've met at this convention. Rainbow Rowell is another author. She wrote Eleanor and Park. Landline is her newest book that is out, and I believe I've promoted it on the show before. She's great. She's so funny and cute and just a great personality, and her writing is obviously spectacular. Lauren Myrickel, who wrote The Infinite Moment of Us, the best-selling Internet Girls series, and horror novels that are Bliss and Rhymes with Witches and Shine. And they look fantastic. I haven't actually read any of them yet, but they look really, really awesome. Another author you might hear is Gail Forman, and you might know her from If I Stay, which is a movie that is coming out, I think, sometime this year, possibly next year. But it's If I Stay, it's about a girl who gets into a car crash in which her parents die and she is in a coma, and she has to go through the decision of whether she wants to stay and on Earth with her friends and the love of her life, or continue on to whatever comes next with her parents. Lev Grossman, who wrote The Magicians, which has been described as Harry Potter for adults, and it looks totally awesome. I've read, like, the first chapter, and it's, I'm in love with it. I'm totally, everyone I talk to is in love with it. It's probably a really huge nerd book, so definitely check that out. Miranda Lowe, who wrote Ash, and this is the book that I definitely want to read by her. Ash is a retelling of Cinderella, but with a lesbian twist. So it sounds awesome and totally up my alley. Stephanie Perkins, who is probably one of the newest authors there, and she wrote a really cute series of romance, young adult romance novels. The first is Anna and the French Kiss, Lola and the Boy Next Door, Isla and the Happily Ever After, and she is super cute. You can kind of see her in her books. The last author, or kind of author you might hear, is Amber Benson, and you will know her from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She played Tara in the later seasons. And I have to say that when I first saw her on the panel, I was like, I know her from somewhere. I know her. Like, I have just seen her face on television. And obviously, I figured it out. And she has got to be the coolest, most interesting, and very knowledgeable person that I've ever, like, seen on a panel. She is, I'm just in love with her now. She is awesome. So these are some of the awesome voices you might hear, their insights and all that good stuff. I will try to keep the sound as good as possible. I mean, I was in a convention room, so obviously it wasn't like they were sitting right next to me and talking to my microphone, even though that would have been awesome. The next panel that I went to was called We Need Diverse Books, and in that panel you'll hear from Alaya Don Johnson, Varian Johnson, Lori Halls Anderson, Miranda Lowe, and I believe Lauren Myrickle, as well as their publisher who moderated the panel. It's a great panel, very interesting insight, and a very diverse author list. So listen to it, check it out. If you can't understand it, I do apologize. I tried to make the volume and the sound as best as I could possibly get it. So here's your first panel, and enjoy.
It's also a lineup that has talked about this topic a lot. Like, we've all either published a lot of diverse books, written them, and so I wonder if we could start by, like, talking about what we mean when we say diverse books. Like, that's such an all-encompassing thing. What do you think of when you think of diversity?
I'll start just because I do this, like, every week for Diversity in YA. Yeah. So for Diversity in YA, we had a very specific goal in mind. My friend Cindy Cron and I co-founded this in 2011, and we did a national tour, and Cheryl and Marianne were both on our tour in 2011. And what we were looking for were YA books that had a main character of color, or a main character who was LGBTQ, or a main character who had a disability. Because we really want to highlight these books where people who are traditionally marginalized by the mainstream actually become the central hero. There are so many books out there where you have the gay best friend or the black best friend, and this is just, those books are very important, and they can serve a really wonderful role in the promotion of diversity. But as a person of color, as a lesbian, you know, I want to read books where people like me are the hero. So for me, when I talk about diversity in YA, I'm talking about main characters who lead the story, who tell their own story.
Let me add on to that. Similar to Melinda, I and some friends started something called the Brown Bookshelf in 2008, where we wanted to highlight books written featuring African Americans, or books written by African Americans. So when we looked at diversity in literature for young adults, we again wanted to focus on the authors as well. Too, we felt that a lot of authors were marginalized with what they could write about. They could only write about certain experiences. Certainly in the African American community, a lot of us felt like you can only write about, you know, slavery or the struggle. And, you know, we wanted to encompass a number of things, but science fiction or whatever else. So we looked at it from both the character's point of view and the author's point of view.
Hell yes. Oh my God, yes. Like, I come from
a science fiction fantasy background. Like, that was what I read when I was growing up. I've always read books written for younger readers, and I've always read science fiction fantasy, which is, like, a great kind of monstrous overlap of those Venn diagrams, which I think is really great. But I have to say, it's not a whatever subfield. There's that default that we talk about in American culture of a kind of straight white male default is in, like, young and skinny and all those sorts of things is, like, even more true, like, super true in science fiction and fantasy. And so to be a young reader of that was, you know, I mean, in some ways it was more freeing because I felt like I was reading stuff that was so different from my own reality that I could kind of forget about the fact that it was also really straight and white and, like, all these things that I was not. But I also felt like, and so when I was reading, like, regular kind of realistic contemporary fiction, like, the fact that it was completely ignoring my existence was, like, more clear. But as I got older, I could not either ignore the fact of the other stuff. Like, my genre was ignoring my existence. And so to write science fiction fantasy as a woman of color is, I think, like, an even greater step, but I think it's really exciting because what's happening now is, like, so many more of us are writing. Like, every year, this is sort of, like, this burgeoning, this amazing, just wonderful group of writers who are inspiring new writers, and new writers are coming into the genre, and I think that's, like, but that's it's a phenomenon of the last 5 or 10 years, I think. You know, so when we were kind of coming up, that stuff wasn't around, so we all, I kind of suspect, started writing it in order to create it, you know? It's like, well, no one else is going to do it.
That kind of speaks to the next question I'm going to ask, which is that you've all written a very diverse genre. It's like, Laurie has 2 wonderful historical novels, with a 3rd on the way, Chains and Forge, about African Americans in the Revolutionary War period. And very in your most recent novel, a heist novel, and of course you two write science fiction. What has been your experience writing diversity into these genres? Like, were you reacting against specific things, like as Elias said, or what were you... Did you set out with a conscious intention of bringing diversity into the genre, or how did it influence the writing of it?
Well, I'll start first. Cheryl knows a lot of this story. So when I got the idea for The Great Green Heist, I had just come from seeing Ocean's 13. Loved the movie, great, loved all the Ocean's movies, but I was really ticked off with kind of the lack of diversity. There's this great shot at the end of Ocean's 13 where you have the main characters, you have Danny Ocean and Rusty Ryan, and Linus in the airport, and they're kind of sitting there in their jackets and looking back and nodding. So that's great, but those are 3 straight white dudes. I really wish that, you know, other players had a bigger part. You know, you do have other ethnicities as part of the crew, but they're not the main guys. And, you know, there's really no women as part of the crew as well, too. So that's kind of what generated the idea for The Great Green Heist. I wanted to do a heist movie, a movie. A heist movie. Anybody wants to do a movie? A heist book, a con book, but I wanted to make it diverse. I wanted it to reflect the diversity that I saw in a lot of the school business I was doing, a lot of the places I was talking, and that's kind of where it started. But I also wanted to write a book featuring diversity, but not about diversity. I've done that, and I think it has its place. So I don't want to knock that. I think writing about books that talk about a culture's and ethnicity's culture is important. I just didn't want to focus on that on this novel. I want it to be about the con, about the heist, about the characters, but I didn't want the diversity, the ethnicity of the characters to play a supremely strong, place in the story. Although it colors it. It always does. Anyway, but that's kind of how I came about it. It was a twofold mission. I wanted to write this high story, and I wanted to show a little bit more diversity.
So I wrote a book a long time ago called Fever 1793, which some of you had to do a project on in 6th grade. I hope you liked all the blood and guts I put in it, because that was you. But that book really changed my life because I love being an American. I am probably the whitest woman in America. And as a result of that, as being privileged, straight, you know, middle class, never thought too much. And then, you know, I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s. You know, I was like a little kid. I was like 10. And I lived on a college campus then, and we had that moment, Age of Aquarius. And in that bubble of privilege, I just kind of looked around and,
Kirk was kissing everybody on Star Trek, and, you know, regardless of their species or if they were a human being, the shade of their skin, and I thought, oh, everything's okay. You know, very thick bubble I lived in. And so then when I was researching Fever 1793, I found out that my number one American hero was not who I thought he was, and that was Benjamin Franklin. And I adored Benjamin Franklin. I tell people I would have dated him if he'd gone to my high school. And there was a lot of great things that man did, but he was a slave owner almost his entire adult life. And we choose not to look at that as Americans because that's confusing and it's hard to... our brains are so scrawny and we feel like we can't jive that with the fact that he also did good things for the country. And when I found out that Benjamin Franklin made a lot of money from the recovery of fugitive slaves, and he made a lot of money from the stolen services of the people he owned, I realized I didn't know my country's history. And that's what set me on, it's almost a 20-year journey now, of trying to understand, as a person born into such incredible privilege, what's my country's history and what's my responsibility within that history? And I think if God gifted me with anything, I have the ability to talk about and write about things that make people uncomfortable. I do it with my YA literature, and boy, if you want to see me shut down a room of white people like that. It's amazing. And if they're white people my age, they all go this... like a broomstick just went in a very uncomfortable place. And you can see in their faces, they're all going, oh my God, would she please start talking about rape again? Because I can't go there. So that's how I got there.
How about you, Melinda?
I did not start out consciously writing about diversity. But my first novel, Ash, is a lesbian retelling of Cinderella. And when I first started writing it, I thought it was going to be a straight retelling of Cinderella. So I wrote the first draft, and she was straight, and she fell in love with Prince, blah, blah, blah. I sent it to a friend of mine to read, and she was like, you know, the main character doesn't really have that much chemistry with the prince. She really seems to like this other character. And the other character was a woman in the book, and I got it back from her with these comments, and I was like, what? So I reread it and I realized my friend was totally right. I had written in this like lesbian subtext. I decided, you know, I could either try to make the prince more sexy and give them more chemistry, or I could turn it into a lesbian Cinderella. And the idea of turning it into a lesbian Cinderella seemed completely ridiculous. I was like, I've never heard of that. No one is ever going to want to buy that. I'm going to make the prince sexier. So I gave him like a scar on his eyebrow. Go for it, and I rewrote it basically from scratch and turned it into lesbian Cinderella. And to my shock and surprise, there was no problem with getting it published. So since then, I have been more conscious about diversity in my books, and I think that writing Ash was really a coming out process to myself. Not only that I could write books about gay characters and they would be able to be published, but I felt so comfortable doing it. It was really wonderful. I could tell stories that I had never personally had a chance to read in my life, you know? So it was very satisfying to me. And that's why I write what I write now, and I hope to in the future.
What you're saying about the experience of publishing a lesbian Cinderella, like, to me that, as a publisher and an editor, that sounds really appealing, just as a pitch, because you could say that in two words and you instantly know...
It's totally my concept.
I've never heard that story before, that's great. And also, like, there's a very distinct market of people that would appeal to, you know, and things like that. I wondered if you all could talk about about that experience of publishing something that is somewhat unique within the industry, and both the pros and the cons of that, as you've seen it. Like,
Yeah, I wrote The Summer Prince because...
Which is awesome.
I had a deadline. Like, I had a book that somebody was going to pay me for, and I just couldn't write it. And I was like, I just was like stressing out, and everything's horrible, and I had this other idea. And it was like, this is actually great because my cousin is here, and she was one of the people who helped me. Like, I told this, like, the story of The Summer Prince to her first. Like, of anybody, like, this is, that was, she was the person. I was like, so I got this incredibly weird idea, it's about a pyramid city, and there's this, they have a king, and it's a matriarchal, and every 5 years, they ritually sacrifice him, and this doesn't sound really exciting, and she was like, my best fan, because he said, yes, Eli, that sounds fabulous. Because everybody else I tried to tell this to was like, so you want to write a novel about a matriarchal society in the African diaspora community in Brazil with... that's all about the transformative power of art. Yeah, that sounds like it's going to sell many copies. So, I mean, but look, I had a book I was supposed to write. Like, there was money that was going to come to me. It was going to pay my rent. And I had Amtrak points, and I just, like, spent them all to get a 3-day train trip from New York to Vancouver. And I took this opportunity to write what I thought I was going to take 2 weeks. I'm going to go to Vancouver. I'm going to like forget all my life. And I'm just going to write this novel in 2 weeks, you know, because you can do that. And that's easy. And I started it. I had some very interesting scene partners who every once in a while I would look over when I was writing something. And if you read this book, you can imagine what the reaction of the in the corridor through Montana got. And they were looking over their shoulders at the words that I was typing on the screen. They were like, so, is that a letter? So I mean, that was how I started. But, I mean, I felt like there was no audience. No one was going to buy it. I couldn't imagine what I was thinking. Every time I described it, and I'm very bad at describing my books, too, so it's part of the problem. Like, I had no high concept. Like, every time I tried to describe it, the description got longer and longer and longer. So I finished it a year later. Then I wrote the other book. So I have this book. Now I have to sell it, and I don't know how I'm going to do that. And I was like very lucky, and I had a friend. She read it. She loved it. She helped me, like, hook me up with her agent. And I was like, this isn't going to sell. And like, seriously, Arthur bought this book in 2 weeks, which is great. As I learned later, everybody was like, Arthur Levine bought your book in 2 weeks. And everybody's last this week has been amazing. Just the support there has been astonishing. And I would honestly never have thought, and I don't know if this would have happened like 10 years ago, to have like that much support and that kind of like automatic, yes, there's an audience, we understand this, we know how to market it. I mean, on the other hand, I got some extremely weird rejection. So my feeling that this book was not going to be for all people, I think was true. I think what's changed is that there are people who recognize exactly who it's for and like know that the audience is there.
So that was We Need Diverse Books. This next panel is called I Made You, You're Perfect. And in this panel, you'll hear from Lev Grossman, Rainbow Rowell, Stephanie Perkins, and Gail Forman. And I also believe Lauren Miracle is in this one as well. It's another great list of authors, and they have some very interesting things. The first thing you're going to hear is Rainbow Rowell talking like a man. So, enjoy.
Hello. I'm apparently a man. Let me say something about video games. I don't know. Sex.
And so I was very scared, and I actually stopped writing that book. Because I was like, whoa, I don't want to write about a dude. That's not why I came to this party. But then I went back to it, and what kind of got me around it was realizing that, first of all, there's no universal male experience in the same way that there's no universal female experience. So you don't have to write from the point of view of a man and write from the point of view of every man. You know, you can write a singular character. That character only has to be true to himself and to his story. And also, I read lots of books written by men. I've read your books. And quite often, not necessarily in Lev's books, but quite often I find myself just loving a female character and feeling like she's so true. actually in your books, I do like them. He's not paying attention, he's thinking ahead. I'm trying to like rip on him. So anyway, if I've fallen in love with female characters written by men, I thought, well, why can't I write a great male character who feels real? And also, we're surrounded by men all the time. And if you are a woman, you swim in a culture that is a male culture. You know, so our media is in a male voice. So much of our lives, we are in a male voice all the time. So if you have men constantly telling you what they think and how they feel. So I don't think it's like writing from the point of view of like a panda or a unicorn.
There's no one panda experience.
No, there's
not. Question for Stephanie. So you don't write from the male point of view, but you write guys that...
No, I'm feeling so bad now. I'm like trying, like I should...
No. So you write, but you write guys that your own characters fall in love with and that we all fall in love with too. So when you're trying to create that guy, my guess is, I haven't asked you this in person, you want to be sure not to create just a perfect, you know, boyfriend kind of guy, and you want to make him flawed. But what else do you think about in your head when you're trying to create this guy who actually on the page turns out to be pretty freaking awesome, like Lev?
This is a really great question, not just for that last little bit, which I really like.
You did my question! That was...
No, but I want everybody to answer, because it is very tempting when you're writing a romance, and you're sort of...
To write Lev,
you got, everybody does it. When you're writing, you know, when you're writing a romance, you're writing desire, to make a fantasy the object of a desire, just go for your fantasy boyfriend or girlfriend, just make them up, because it's so easy, one thinks about it all the time anyway. But is that what you do? And does that make for good writing? Go.
Yeah, it's totally what I do. And they are all you. I just put different hair on them.
We've got our spit take, folks.
Don't
minute
give away
17.
The secret.
The most important thing for me when I'm writing is that I'm writing characters, because mine are definitely love stories. That is the bulk of the story. It's not a story about this and with the romance. Like they are a love story, and it's important to me that both characters deserve each other and earn each other. And so they both are flawed. They both grow. They both have things that complement each other that they can help out with. And so for me, the most important thing when I'm creating one of the male characters is that level of friendship. And would these people actually be friends and really get along? Is it more than just, I find this person attractive and I want to jump them? And for me, a big part of that, too, is, you know, just because I'm writing, you know, guys who I want to hang out with, I don't hang out in the, like, really jockey, sporty, like, super buff guy crowd, like the boys I was always interested in.
Newsflash, Stephanie Perkins does not play beach volleyball.
You'd be shocked, right? So I'm writing, you know, like really nice, cool guy, you know, like my idea of cool, and they like comic books and history books, and they make inventions.
They can't
so
find their abs.
No, there's not a lot of working out and like sexy, like their bodies are sexy, but they're sexy because like that is what my characters are into, you know, so for me, making them real is making them something that I see that, you know, all the people in the years who I've been friends with or who I've been attracted to, like I'm pulling as many different things in there so I can create one person who isn't just this super good-looking guy, because that's boring.
But do you make the attraction instant, or is there like initial conflict, and then they sort of, you know, they do snappy, you know, bickering, and then they come to realize that they love each other?
Yeah, it is. It's a pretty instant attraction because you know,
sometimes one-sided.
Because
though.
Right, or they don't realize it's the full thing. It's not a, like, we instantly jump into a relationship. It's complicated. There are problems that they have to work through, but it is, like, that initial crushy thing, like, acknowledging that someone is attractive, but then, like that's not the thing that's actually going to make them want to be with someone, because I can look at anyone and be like, oh, you're really attractive, you guys are all really attractive. but I'm going to need a little more information before I know I want to date you. So yeah, there's instant attraction, but it's not instant in bed.
that well. You're doing well.
No, that's good. That's good. I
think Stephanie does really well when she's writing about attraction. There's this idea that I think does show up in when you were describing, like, they meet and they bicker, and I was thinking of, like, a really bad romantic comedy. And something that I think happens when romance seems false to me is they either write two people who are exactly the same, which is, I think, like, a very juvenile way of looking at it. Like, well, if I find someone who also... as I say this, I'm like, my husband and I did bond over Star Wars, but, like, you don't necessarily... Sometimes I think you think, like, he has to like this and this and this, and, you know, we have to be just alike. Or there's this rom-com version of attraction where opposites attract, I'm great, he's an ass. You're made for each other. And I don't find that to be true either. I find in real life when people fall in love, they're this kind of complicated bundles of sames and differences. I think that works really well in your books because it's not as if you're writing about two people who would never be together, ever. You're writing about two people who kind of seem like they should be together, but what happens in real life is you sort of feel like you should be together, and then you hit up against all of each other's rocky parts, and you're kind of trying to make that work. So I think that works really well, and when a love story feels real like that, it's, for me, it's so much more moving.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can you always speak about my book?
Sure.
You're much more
one thing that makes me think about your idea that there's this idea of bickering and blah, blah, blah. One thing I realized when I was writing about these two 18-year-olds who were falling in love and fell hard and fell fast is that fight's not the right word and bicker's not the right word, but how the hell do you deal with your emotions and articulate them and work things out? Is sometimes, I mean, maybe that's the equivalent, and I found that it was really a challenge to write about characters who did stupid things because they didn't know yet how to not do stupid things, and they didn't know yet how to say, this is, like, I tell my kids all the time, if you can't talk about sex, you shouldn't be having sex. And then I found out that I was writing this book about these kids who have sex. It's really hard. I mean, it's a lot easier to have sex than to talk about, I feel scared when, or I feel vulnerable when. And so that was what looked like fighting was really two people going like this and being scared and not quite knowing how to handle it.
I think the key to, first of all, when you read a love story on the page that feels real and earned, you know it because you get that feeling in your stomach. And I think reading one and writing one, I think when you've read one like that, it's because it's been written well, obviously. But I think that writing a love story like that is somewhat like actually falling in love itself, in that there's a chemistry that happens. And the thing with writing it is, unlike real life where you can't force it, also you can't force it in your writing either, but you can sometimes manipulate pieces to see if you can get there. But you know it when it's happening, and sometimes it just happens right away. You put characters on the page, and it is there. And sometimes you have to kind of do some thinking about these people and what they answer in each other, and ask each other to find it. But that is the sort of key. Like, I know when I've hit a love story because writing it feels like falling in love myself.
I really like that, what they answer in each other. I think that's a great bit. The other thing is you're asking different questions at different points in your life. And so, the last book I wrote was about adults who've been in love for, like, almost 20 years. And so I keep getting asked, like, what's the difference? Why did writing about teens or adults? And something you said, Lauren, when I write about young people falling in love, I feel like they're crueler to each other because they almost don't know the violence because they haven't been hurt like that before. But when you're writing about someone who's been in love for 15 years, there's so much, they can be so much more contained because they've learned which things cut the hardest and which things are hardest to recover from. So when I was writing in my recent book, Landline, about Georgie and Neil, their fights when they were younger were just so much bloodier than their fights when they were older. Even though when you're older, the fights maybe hurt more, they're less bloody because you have to learn how to fight with each other.
So that was I Made You, You're Perfect. It was a really great panel. I'm cutting that one a little bit shorter than normal, mainly because the next panel that I went to on the Lit Trek was called I Love Trash, and it was such a great panel that I really, really want to get to that one and have time to hear it. So that one you will hear from Amber Benson, Lev Grossman, Stephanie Perkins, Rainbow Rowell, Lauren Myrickle, and Aliyah Dawn Johnson. And I believe Holly Black was in this one as well. So take a listen. There's some awesome, awesome points in it. So enjoy.
Wow, I'm trying to think of something that I like that's not trashy. I'm a big fan of the original Captain America comics. Captain America, he's not cool.
That's not trashy.
Okay, whoa, this, we're not gonna, this is not like, you know, one downsmanship kind of thing. I mean, I could go down from there. That's my starting bid. Oh, sorry, I left our screen.
Who are you?
I'm Amber Benson, and I spent the summer that I was 14, drove cross country from Alabama to Los Angeles. And with my mom and my sister. We stopped at my Aunt Carolyn's, and she belonged to the Harlequin Book of Monk Club. And so for my 14th year, I spent a trip reading Harlequins from a giant garbage bag, reading them in the car in the back, and leaving them in hotel rooms like Indian Bibles.
Hey, I'm Aliyah Dawn Johnson, and probably the trashiest thing that I really love is an old series, I think it's from like the late 80s or early 90s, called Harem. And it's like a kind of epic mini television miniseries starring Omar Sharif and that woman from 3 Men and a Baby. I forget. You're like the mother.
Nancy Travis.
She is really, really mad, but oh my god. This is like, and it's just like, it's one of these horrible kind of fantasies. She goes to, like, the Ottoman Empire, like, right before its fall, and it gets stuck in Omar Sharif's harem, but she's, like, the most specialist white woman who's ever in that harem. she makes him fall in love with her by her interesting refusal to have sex. It's like every single stupid cliche you can hit, but man. I remember, like, my friend and I would come over, and he'd be like, we're gonna go down to the basement and watch Harem. Like, we didn't want to tell anyone because it was so embarrassing. That how many times we watched this movie, and she got worse and worse with all the other characters. Because, I mean, she's in the Ottoman Empire, so all these really interesting, crazy characters from, like, different social economic statuses and all these different ethnic groups, and all of them are actually really well played, you know, so you just kind of, like, forgot that she was around, but it was trashy, all right, I got it. It's so trashy.
I would never use the word trashy, but I know I get a lot of grief for certain things that I like. And I get a lot of grief kind of depending on the circle that I'm in. So last night I was at a table where they were making fun of people who had Disney World on their honeymoon. And I was like, I went to Disney World. Because, like, I'd never really, where I live, people don't travel. You know, I get some money to travel, so it's kind of like you're getting on a plane for the first time ever, you better go to Disney World. You might never do it again. And then, I take grief for it. I love Disney theme parks in a way that some people, it depends on the room. This is probably not a room where that's going to be very judged. But this probably will be. I still love the Twilight books. Yeah! I love them. I wouldn't call them trashy. I would love them. I also, again, I wouldn't call this trashy, but some people would. I love Outlander. I love it.
Yes.
I'm taking, I know. The cover. So sometimes the cover of a book will make
the original cover.
To which I have the original cover.
I got the, like, classier second round of covers. Now they're on to, like, a third round.
I guess the first, like, I've always loved things that a lot of people have considered trashy, and I don't really believe in that concept. But the first one that, like, really comes to mind is when I was younger, and everyone was reading, like, the classic Yellow Spine Nancy Drew. And not the super, super classic white ones that they've reissued in our, like, don't pick those up. If you guys have, like, did you know that, like, Nancy Drew is really crazy racist? It's really bad. Avoid that one. There's a reason why they reissued them with those yellow covers and took all the horrible things out. I made that mistake, ruined my childhood. But those weren't the ones I was really reading anyway. I liked the Nancy Drew Files. And in the Nancy Drew Files, Nancy and Ned, like, had, like, a real relationship. Like, they just kind of hint at it, and he's like, he's basically like her assistant and the others, which is cool that she's doing all the legwork in Nancy Drew. But in the Nancy Drew files, like, they're really like boyfriend and girlfriend and like making out and stuff. It's way more Sweet Valley High. And so that was what I wanted to read, and all of my friends kind of had a lot of disdain for that.
First of all, I like white Zinfandel wine. Like the rest of y'all, I'd say love what you love and love fits something like little children and you're a grown man and they're not, you know what I'm saying. But other than that, love what you love. And I loved The Flowers in the Attic. Happy to not. I also loved, if anybody else, I read this again and again. It was a tearjerker about, it was called Johnny, but it's spelled J-O-N-I, about a girl who dove off and broke her neck and drew things with her mouth.
Oh my
you
God.
Read that too?
Yes.
You met Johnny? She was awesome. It was very inspirational. She was paralyzed from the neck down, and then she patched it up. Her drawings were in the book, and she used her mouth.
That was a really upsetting book.
I loved that.
When her friends come and visit her for the first time,
oh,
like 6 months after the accident,
Johnny.
They're chatting with her. It's really nice. And then they go outside, and she can see them out the window, and they're sobbing hysterically. And one of them throws up. It's so terrible. You remember that part? This is a really sad book. And when she's wearing her best bathing suit when she takes her dime.
That she wanted the bathing
suit. And they have to cut
suit.
It off her, and she's like, no.
The
no,
bathing
cut
suit cutting off scene. Yeah, that was. Yeah.
I've never met anybody else who's read this book.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, did you see the movie Multiples? Also, Ice Castles. Loved Ice Castles. But the only book that I've actually not been comfortable reading in public, and I read the whole thing, but only the one, was 50 Shades of Grey.
Well, that segues really nicely into the next thing that I really wanted to talk about.
When you were planning your moderation of this panel.
Exactly. In the last 30 seconds. Inspired by your very comment. No. I have a feeling that most of us on this panel don't really like the idea of certain things being called trashy or guilty pleasures. I just kind of have a feeling, and so if you disagree with that, I do hope you speak up on that at some point. But going on the assumption that most of us feel that way in general, are there any exceptions? Can you guys think of any exceptions to that rule? Things that that really do fall under that?
I think I have personal exceptions, but I try not to enforce them on other people.
Yeah,
like I can't believe I left on fan fiction. Like all I read. Well, Starbucks. And it's funny because within fan fiction, I was at the fan fiction meetup last year, and I talked to the two women sitting next to me, and but the things that they read, I was thinking, oh my God, I would never read that. But I would never say that,
Right. So you still—that's a good follow-up in that, like, you still feel judgy. Do you feel judgy? Like you, because I'll feel judgy sometimes.
Like, it's funny, I'm not gonna read it, but
yeah, I mean,
I have a stepsister named Marielle. I'm looking at my children, and almost every book she reads, I say, Marielle, that's awesome, because she wants me to read them too. And then I'm always like, ugh. So what was that one about? There was the cabin. Do you remember something about a cabin? And it was
the
all
shack?
Religious and the shack. Oh, it was the shack. Yep, that one. And then also sketchy, judgy. Women are from wherever. The guys are from somewhere else. Yep. I felt judgy about that one. And then there's one. Oh, the bridge. The one about the bridge that was all the bridges of Matthew. Yeah, I felt judgy. So I feel judgy about all of those.
I guess I'd say I feel like we're talking about two different things that are kind of related, right? Like there's the way that you critique a work of fiction TV show or any kind of creative work based on criteria that you have. And then there's a sort of like preformed judgment you have of something based on its social characteristics, but has nothing to do with what the work is actually, like its actual value. I mean, and I'm assuming here that there's some method of determining some kind of value of like a person judging, which is maybe a position that, you know, you could argue against. But I kind of do feel like it's possible to say that something is better, many qualifiers than something else. I'd say, yes, I would agree with that. So from that perspective, I can say, you know, I feel like something's kind of trashy. In the sense that I think the harem is bad. It's bad. You know, it's not like, for example, Joanna Bourne is a romance writer, and she writes the most amazing historical romances, which, like, if you like any historical fiction at all, like, go out and buy Joanna Bourne, because she is ridiculously good. And so that is kind of like the guilty pleasure that I think is a terrible way to call it, because that's nothing but marketing and nothing but, like, basically culture judging women for liking romances. I mean, like, that's, and to me, or like, and women as central characters and stories, and like, that to me is a terrible way of judging things. The problem is, you know, because of a lot of, like, accents, a lot of things that end up getting published in those genres is really bad. Not, like, things that don't get published in other genres are terrible.
Most things that get published are bad.
Exactly. But they get associated with that badness. And I also think that, unfortunately, there's a certain kind of ghettoization that happens so that people end up, like, they could write books that have more diversity. They could write books that deal with other kind of historical issues. They could write books, but they don't, because the industry is pushing them in a very, very, very narrow mold. And I think that's because that whole genre doesn't get respect. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like this, like, ongoing, like, rolling down a hill cycle. And I think that can end up kind of affecting people's opinion of the genre.
And also, who likes it? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes I think the audience determines, too, like, if it's something a lot of teenage girls like, or if it's something that a lot of, like,
yes,
women
absolutely
over 50 like.
Absolutely.
And so I can love Craft Bros and Captain America, but I think comic books have changed. The way that we judge people who read comic books is radically different now than it would have been when I was a teenager, even.
Well, so much of this stuff. I mean, when I grew up, I mean, I was a big fantasy nerd, there was a significant stigma associated with that. Because we didn't have Harry Potter yet, the idea that could be mainstream didn't exist, and we didn't know that there were a lot of us because we didn't have the internet to just like reveal as people. So we thought we were the only ones, and it was a terrible feeling. And people made us feel terrible about it. It's not so easy now.
It's like the end of Revenge of the Nerds, when we all get up, we are the champions, and everybody gets up.
I didn't say that. That's trash.
A kid starts breakdancing in the middle of the violin.
Well, I think when I was a teenager, the trashy thing was, like, if you read Stephen King, he was looked down on so much. Yes, totally. Stephen King was like, people just love to talk crap about Stephen King in the 80s. And I just don't feel like that exists anymore. Do you disagree?
No, I'm screeching in. I feel like I need to like do a slight personal background, which is that I grew up in like the castle of like Judge Arino. My parents were both English professors. They had PhDs. They taught at big universities. They were like the great defenders of the canon. So practically everything was trash. Stephen King was trash. Any fantasy or science fiction was trash. We were supposed to read the great books, like even when we were kids, and the great books are so boring, especially when you're a little kid. I grew up and came to love some of them. But the funny thing is, when I started to write fantasy, and I didn't start write fantasy until like mid-career, until I was like 35. Before that, I thought I was going to grow up to be Jonathan Franzen and watch Birds. I escaped that fate narrowly. The weird thing is, when I started writing fantasy, I loved the trashiness of it so much. I loved that it was trash. I wanted them to despise it. And I wanted to do this thing that was despised. Because it felt so radical. I mean, new art that's new, it's people are supposed to despise it.
Right.
You know? I mean, when people are doing things interesting, they're new, they're forbidden, people are supposed to look down on them. And I feel like that was part of how I knew that I was doing something right, is that people judge me for it.
Well, I super duper want to go back to fiction written by women and that's really read by women, but what you were just talking about reminded me of one other genre we're kind of forgetting that still has a lot of negativity attached to it. You touched on this with Stephen King, but I do think horror still has a certain amount of guilty pleasure attached to it, because in a way it's something that's really hard to defend, because if it bothers you, it bothers you, and like you can't deal with it, and you shouldn't try. It's not like it's good for you, I would say. Like maybe, I mean, you can make an argument for anything, but right now I'm working on, my next project is very, very different from the current happy stuff I write. I'm writing a teen slasher.
Yes.
And I had that same reaction that you had, Love, where you like you kind of want people to hate it and be angry. Like I'm not doing, like when I first say horror, people start thinking like Stephen King or something, but like no, I mean like sexy, bloody, like cheese, like the worst kind of film that gets terrible reviews. Like I want that in book form because I love that. Yeah, like
tell
like
us
this,
more.
Like, the Scream films are my favorite, and so I've been doing lots of critical reviews like for the last several years and research on this topic. And the more and more I find about people just like the just despising it, the more I love it.
Don't you have a feeling when you're writing this stuff that somewhere it's hard to picture where geographically? There's like a control room, and in that control room is a map, and on the map is a light, which is represents your location, and it's flashing red. And all these guys with headsets saying, "Oh my God, it's happening! Yeah. We gotta get a SWAT team out there, stat, to stop this being written." And it's the best feeling. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that.
That makes me think of a question, though, because you were saying there's probably not a way to justify horror, and of course I think there is because I love horror, but that made me think about show. There are certain things that, and I think more of TV, but maybe there's books out there that would do it too, that I watch and it really does make me feel yucky, like Intervention, that show Intervention, or and Hoarders, although it's sometimes, you know, entertaining, but I watched it and I really do think I'm watching somebody being exploited, or Honey, Honey, Boo Boo, or Honey, Boo Boo, wait, How Many Boo, and what? Like, so maybe, I don't know, I think there, Aaliyah was asking, is there some, there probably is no objective line, because of course then you get pornography too, and we have different feelings about that, I suspect. Why are you grinning?
I grin because Amber grin.
So, I don't know. I think it's easy for us all to say, yes, we're so cool, we think trashiness is awesome, but then there probably is a spot where we all shift into a different gear.
I was just thinking, you know, I read a lot of, like, what's considered YA fiction now, but when I was growing up, it was just in the kids' section. It was, like, Christopher Pike and Isaiah Hickman, all this stuff that's, like, well, anyways. And then I would fight my mom on literature. She was always like, read literature. I'm like, no, I don't want to read it. And then I read all those Harlequins. And then I read Jane Eyre, and I was like, oh, this is just like the Harlequins. Like, Jane Austen, Jane Eyre, all these, they're amazing writers, but it's dealing with romance and relationships, and they're considered literature. So I think, you know, there's this demarcation that shouldn't be there. It's no different. Reading Jane Eyre was no different than reading the Harlequins that I... There's still, you know, star-crossed lovers fighting to be together and people trying to get in their way. And then, you know, there was no sex, but... That's different.
I saw an expert on Jane Austen talk once, and it was fascinating because he was talking about how she was considered trashy and novels were considered trashy.
Yeah.
That novels were a woman's medium, and that men would never write a novel. That they weren't serious. And then her attitude was like, yeah, good, fine. I'm just like, leave me alone to write my novels then. Just go away.
I mean, the first novel ever written is a Japanese novel by Murasaki Shikibu, which is published 900 AD. I mean, we're talking, and it was in the exact same kind of situation. Like, women weren't considered, like, you know, they were literate, but they were literate in the dialect, or like the written dialect of Japanese, whereas men wrote in Chinese. And so, but she wrote like people spoke, and she wrote novels, and men didn't write novels. They wrote poems, or they wrote like treatises, but they didn't write novels. So she wrote like this. I've seen this thing. It is a brick. Yeah. I mean, it is. It is like, you know, George R. R. Martin might take a step back. And it's beautifully written and incredibly well done. And yes, of course, it was considered like women's stuff. Like that relationship between women's fiction and trash and things that aren't worthy of our attention. And what about the battles? And what about, you know? It's like there's two versions of any story, and one apparently is much less worthy than the other.
I would really love to talk to you guys because I feel like the Q&A has been really short and all the panels. So I'd like to open up the... I saw a hand right there, right away. Let's start there.
So I think some of you mentioned 50 Shades and Twilight. How do you balance wanting a woman-written book written by women for women to be a success versus the potentially problematic and abusive relationships modeled in those books.
Something you mentioned at the top in talking about harem is, as you're enjoying it, you're acknowledging all the problems with it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And this, by the way, is the way like I enjoy 90% of the things that I enjoy. I mean, to some extent, that's true of everything, right? Like, you can't, nothing is perfect. There's always going to be problems. I think living as a woman in our culture, living as a person of color in our culture, living as anybody who's, like, deviating from the norm, this is, like, extra true because there's things you're more aware of. You can hardly watch, especially very popular things. Anything that's very, especially very popular in the United States, like, that kind of comes with baggage. Which doesn't mean you can't enjoy it, but I do think it's important to acknowledge the baggage and not, like, dismiss it out of hand because, like, women romance, you know, weird and icky and, like, you know, that kind of dismissal is bad for everyone. But a more nuanced acknowledgement of problematic aspects and the way that sexism can, like, infiltrate, like, the way women talk and think about ourselves, you know? I mean, that's really an issue. And I think that's coming out of this book.
I don't know how to ask this exactly, because I don't know your background, but from listening to you talk on two different panels now, you're extremely articulate, extremely smart, you know a lot about literature. I'm guessing maybe you have an advanced degree in English or some sort, or you went to college, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are an excellent critical reader. You have excellent critical reading skills. What about the people I see on the treadmill at the gym reading 50 Shades of Grey, or the young girls who...
Well, they might have gone to college.
They might have.
I don't know why anyone went to college and be on a treadmill.
But I'm just not sure, and I don't know what the answer is, but I doubt that everybody is as good of a critical thinker as you are, or has had as much experience, which is not to say that they can't be, but I think my stepsister buys a lot of that stuff hook, line, and sinker.
I think there is a danger of normalizing that kind of behavior and of thinking that, and of making us second guess things that make us feel uncomfortable as women in relationships. I think that those sorts of super alpha male narratives are problematic in that way. I'm not sure the answer to that, because I agree with you. Like, how can you not expect people to be able to, like, critically look at these things? On the other hand, stories change the world, and stories change the way we look at the world. And if there's a lot of stories that make that kind of super alpha male, I'm the chic, and I'm going to, like, rape you until you enjoy it sort of novel, if that is, like, the only dominant narrative, that's going to have some effect on people's kind of internal vision of what relationships should look like.
Education. You know, we're not educating our children to think critically, to think ethically and morally. You know, we're not spending money on education, we're spending it on other things. We're not encouraging children to think outside the box. It's standardized testing, it's regurgitation of fact instead of, critical thinking for yourself. If we teach our children to think for themselves, if we question them about what they're reading, about what they're looking at, and what they're doing in their lives, if we're engaged with them as adults, we're going to grow a society of people that think for themselves and can read things critically and not take things literally. You know?
Amen. So that was I Love Trash, the last panel that I went to on that day. And of course, that was my amen that you heard. Amber Benson is, that just made me love her a million times over. So if you're interested in any of these authors, I will have links to all of their pages and books on the show notes on the blog. Don't forget to follow me on all of the internets, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr. If you met me at LeakyCon and you got one of my cards, please make sure to spread the word and get your friends interested if this is something you think that they might like to listen to. We'll have more next week. This Thursday, we're going to read Chapter 10, and we'll have a new discussion next Sunday. Thanks for your time, and I'll see you then. Bye. Doing It by the Book is written and produced by Jane Austier. Original music is composed and performed by Daniel Lott. For more information, check out D-Lo Games on YouTube. If you like the discussion episodes of DIBTB and want to support the show and the guest hosts, please rate, comment, and promote the podcast. Also, you can now click the donate link on the webpage. Comments? Questions? Please follow me on Twitter at Jane Austere, email me at dibtbpodcast@gmail.com, or check out the website dibtbpodcast.blogspot.com. Be happy to hear from you.